welcome to the Alaska Uncovered podcast with me, your host, Jenny Twing Flaming. I bring you accurate, helpful, and entertaining information about Alaska travel and life in Alaska. My occasional co-host and full-time husband, Jay, and I are committed to keeping the Alaska Uncovered podcast ad-free. To do that, we need your help. If you are enjoying this podcast, we invite you to contribute to our tip jar, which is the first link in the show notes. You don't need any account or anything like that. You can just do a one-time tip. Really easy. We are so grateful for our listeners, and we couldn't do this without you. Thank you so much, and enjoy the show. Everyone, Jenny here again. This episode is mostly a rewind of one of the earliest episodes of the podcast that Jay and I did during National Parks Week in 2023, just a year ago. At that point, the podcast was just 6 weeks old, so it was one of the very earliest episodes. And Jay and I wanted to bring this up to the front again because it is National Parks Week again. National parks are a place people are really excited about going in Alaska for very good reason. And the information in this episode is still excellent and really our best advice. So we wanted to share it again this year. It includes Jay sharing a bit about his experience growing up in the National Park Service and also working as an archaeologist in Gates of the Arctic National Park in Alaska. We also talk about the challenges with some of the more remote Alaska national parks and all kinds of different details about how to visit each one of them, along with our own personal experiences there. Before we go to that, I wanted to quickly recap most of the episodes of the podcast that are about national parks. So if you've missed any, you can go back and catch them. So this is in chronological order, starting from the beginning of the podcast in March 2023 up until now. So the first one, March 8th, 2023, that was episode 4. It is about visiting Katmai National Park with Katmai Park Ranger Kara. So that is a really fun episode, all about the bears, all about the other cool things to see in Katmai. March 22nd, which was episode 6, is, this is March 22nd, 2023, so way back in the feed, Glacier Bay National Park with Ranger Matt, another super fun episode. May 17th, 2023, episode 14, that is with our friends Tom and Donna Haubecker, who lived in Denali for many years while Tom was working as a ranger, and Donna and I went to grad school together during that time in Fairbanks. And they share all about the park, but also about what it's like to live and raise a family in a remote national park. So that's a fun one. July 12th, 2023, episode 22 is about climbing Denali, the mountain, with our friend Ryan, who has summited Denali and talks all about that experience and the logistics. Pretty cool episode. And then January 17th, 2024, that's episode 47. That one is all about how to plan a trip to Denali National Park if you're traveling on your own and not with a tour group or on a cruise tour. So that can be a little bit challenging and different from what people expect. So that's what that episode is about. And finally, February 21st, 2024, episode 54 is about flight seeing over Denali National Park and landing on the Ruth Glacier, seeing Denali from the air. And that was with Cole Chambers from K2 Aviation. One more, I just wanted to let you know, very soon on May 15th, we will have an episode about Wrangell St. Elias National Park and the town of McCarthy with Avery, who is a guide there and grew up in McCarthy. So that is going to be a super fun episode, and I can't wait to share it with you. So with that, happy National Parks Week, and enjoy the episode. In today's episode, Jay and I are talking all about the national parks in Alaska. Jay and I actually met in an Alaskan national park, Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park, which is in Skagway, which basically is the town of Skagway. And Jay has also worked in Gates of the Arctic National Park as an archaeologist for 3 seasons. He also grew up in Yellowstone, so he is a child of the National Park Service as well. Today, we're going to share about Alaska parks in general, some tips about visiting, and about some of our personal favorite spots. So to start us off, Jay, can you share a little bit about your personal history with the National Park Service and the parks in Alaska that you've been to?
Ooh, I just realized this is my first experience as a guest on this show. How fun.
It is fun. Yeah.
I actually feel a little bit more on, like I have to perform a little better than when I'm just the occasional co-host. So I want to first say that, yes, I grew up in the National Park Service. And in the National Park Service, I am what is called a park brat, which is a term for any child who was raised in the Park Service, and in particular, then went on to work in the Park Service themselves. And it's a kind of a term of endearment, but, you know, it has a little bit of a cutting edge to it, too.
But yes,
it's a small fraternity of us out there. But yeah, so when I was in elementary school, my folks moved into Yellowstone Park, and my dad was a truck driver and worked on the road crew and plowed snow, worked in maintenance in Yellowstone. So I did live in the interior of Yellowstone in Grant Village, and we had to leave for the winters because there's no school there. There's only one other child under 18 in the whole area. So we would go out into Wyoming, and I would go to school. And then when I was in high school, my dad moved. He eventually got a job in Mammoth that was year-round, which is the north part of the park, and I graduated from high school up there. And I went up to Alaska, and eventually, after graduate school, I'd worked in the cruise industry and a bunch of other stuff. I ended up becoming an archaeologist and working in the national parks up there. And then when we moved to Seattle, I then did a stint working for the regional office here in the Pacific West and worked in a bunch of parks out here. I should also add that when I was in high school, I did work in the visitor center in Yellowstone too. So I don't work for the Park Service now, but it has actually been about, I don't know, at least 10 years of my life that I've worked directly for the Park Service.
Yeah. That's a long time. That's a lot of history.
It is. I don't even know how many years it's been because I've worked so many stints. And one of the things about a Park Service life is that getting a permanent full-time job is quite challenging. There's a lot of barriers to getting hired for that. But a lot of folks in the Park Service, the majority of park employees, work out their careers in lots of seasonal and temporary appointments. And so it becomes kind of it's a flurry of leaves blowing by you. And you can be like, wait, when, where was, I know I worked in that park. When was that?
Yeah.
What was my job there? What? And so, yeah, the majority of park employees are seasonals. And that was me as well until I worked here in the region. But, so how many parks have we visited together in Alaska? Because you've been to some, I haven't.
Yeah. So I visited you when you were working in Gates. So we've both been there.
Yeah,
and we met in Skagway. So we've both been there to Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park.
We shared the coldest night of camping in my life in Denali.
Yes, real chilly. It was in April. It was kind of awesome, but also we had to go home at like 5 a.m. because it was so cold. Right. I totally remember. Yeah. So we've been to Denali together quite a few times.
Been to Wrangell St. Elias. Yeah. We also managed to ride along on a friend who won the lottery to drive up the road in your personal vehicle at the end of the year once. That was really fun.
That was really fun.
And we've been to Wrangell St. Elias together.
Yes. And we've been to Kenai Fjords together.
Yes.
And Sitka, National Historical Park.
You have been to Glacier Bay. I never have.
Yeah, and I have. You- Glacier Bay is my favorite. It is.
You're such a fangirl.
I know.
I feel like I'm not a very good park brat in that I've never been to several of the quintessential national parks I've never been to. But
yeah.
You've been to Katmai too.
And yes. And I've been to Katmai. I think neither of us have been to Kobuk Valley and neither of us have been inside Lake Clark.
No.
But I believe we've been to all the others, plus many other national park units that don't necessarily have that national park designation, which you're going to talk about in a few minutes. But I think that's all of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Jay, speaking of that, can you tell us a little bit? Well, actually, before we get into that, I should mention that we have several other episodes of the Alaska Uncovered podcast that are about specific national parks in Alaska. And today we're really talking, we will talk about some specifics, but we are talking about Alaska national parks in general, which covers a lot of territory. But just to give you a sense, if you want to know more about Alaska national parks and you're new to the podcast, in episode 3, one of the topics we talked about in that episode was Denali, and specifically visiting Denali in 2023. There are some changes in Denali because of the partial road closure, so that we talked about that. And episode 4 was about Katmai and all about bears, but also more than bears, and all the other things that are cool about Katmai. And episode 6, we talked about Glacier Bay. And episode 10, which was just last week, was about Skagway. And we talked about the National Historical Park in Skagway. And then we also have an episode coming in a couple weeks, in 3 weeks, actually, that will be all about Denali. And then there are some other episodes coming that we have planned about parks. So, but that's just a little bit of an overview of what we've done and covered so far. So, Jay, can you tell us a little bit about kind of public land in Alaska in general? Like, why is there so much federal land in Alaska? What places are the parks in Alaska? What is different about it, maybe from the lower 48?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that I miss about living in Alaska, living down in the lower 48 now, is that 2/3 of Alaska is managed by the federal government. And of the remaining 1/3, a big chunk of it is public land owned by the state. So there's a lot of open space to kind of have a lot of freedom to explore and stuff in it, where, you know, the lower 48 is mostly privately owned. But it's kind of interesting, you know, Alaska. First of all, I should just say I'm not an expert on this topic, and so whatever I say here is, it's for your entertainment value only.
Yes. But I know you're not specifically speaking as a representative of the Park Service or anything like that. Just sharing your perspective. Yeah.
I no longer work for the Park Service anymore. But you know, it's funny, I know a little bit, but more probably mostly just enough to get myself in trouble with this, but this is what I know of. Alaska has a couple of older national parks, Glacier Bay and Denali, which were, you know, they're 100-year-old parks and from the 1920s. But most of the Alaska National Park units were actually formed by a law passed in 1980 called ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Land Claims Settlement Act. Ooh, I think so. Anyway, it's ANILCA. And a little bit by the 1971 law, ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. You know, Alaska was purchased from the Russian government, and a lot of its public land was not settled as to who owned it. You know, there were clear tribal indigenous claims on the land. There were a few private owners, but most of the land was fairly unsettled and fairly inhospitable. So there wasn't a lot of really well-established ownership outside of some of the gold fields. And so the legal nature of all that was still up in the air when people wanted to develop the petroleum resources on the North Slope. And so that was a big barrier to that. And in order to allow the oil pipeline to be built and that to happen, those two laws were critical to settle who owned what pieces of land. And there's a lot of controversy and a lot of history in those two acts. You could spend your whole life studying those, definitely, and still have room. So, but a lot of national park units were set up in that period of time. So Alaska also has some non-national park public lands. There's two big national forests, the Tongass and the Chugiak. And there's a bunch of wildlife refuges. So national forests are managed by the National Forest Service, which is part of the Department of Agriculture. And then the Department of the Interior includes the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they have some national wildlife refuges. But the majority are managed by the Park Service. And I want to bring up here a really common misconception that I see on the internet in general. Jenny, I feel like you've seen a lot of these articles too, where someone lists like what, I don't even remember how many are named national parks in Alaska, or in the list.
There's eight. Yeah.
National parks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Having worked and lived in the National Park Service almost my whole career, there's no real distinction between what is and isn't a national park within the National Park Service unit. And that includes a lot of things that aren't named national park. So I want to just take a moment to nerd out on public land types for a second. I think it is kind of relevant. And
yeah,
I hear folks who have like a bucket list and they have like, I'm going to visit all the national parks. And then when I hear them listening, they're missing things that I think are really important. And I realize it's because the name doesn't include national park. I think of it like this. If someone was telling you the best peaks to climb in the country, and then you said, oh, but what about Denali? Or what about Mount Rainier? Like, oh, those aren't peaks. Those are mounts. I'm talking about Pikes Peak. You know, like those are just naming differences. And yeah, they don't necessarily... They'll have something to do with the history of that mountain, and they might even tell you a little something about it, but they don't necessarily imply some sort of hierarchy, or that they're even, you know, they're all things we call mountains. So in Alaska in particular, this gets a little complicated, but there are national historic areas, national monuments, national parks, national park and preserves, national preserves, but not national park. So there's just a quick rattle off a list. There's the Aleutians National Historic Area, the Aniakchik National Monument, the Alagnak Wild River, Cape Krusenstern National Monument, Denali National Park, Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, Glacier Bay National Park, Katmai is a national park, Kenai Fjords is a national park, Klondike is a national historic park, Kobuk Valley is a national park, Lake Clark is a national park, and then there is Noatak National Preserve, Sitka National Historic Park, Wrangell, and Yukon Charlie National Preserve. The Park Service would consider all of those national parks. They would call them all parks.
Right.
They wouldn't necessarily, and the thing about national parks is each one is created by its own act of Congress, except for national monuments, which I'll talk about in a second. But, and those will govern a lot of the rules, like what is being called out as the exceptional thing about this area, what are we prioritizing, but they're all managed under the larger rubric of the National Park Service to preserve unimpeded, for the benefit and enjoyment of the people, you know, these areas.
Yeah.
So I don't want people to miss and say, like, I want to go to these 8 national parks because those will be the best thing. And the other things, the other types of parks, a lot of times it just means that they came later. So the original national parks are, you know, 100 years ago when the National Park Service was new, they were all just called national parks pretty much. As time went on, they got more creative with naming. So calling something a national, you know, historic landscape, or calling something a national seashore, or that kind of thing, was really a later development. The only distinction I want to make is that national monuments are quite different. They are created by act of the president. The Antiquities Act 1906 gives the president the right to, with the stroke of a pen, create a national monument. It also means that they're a little more tenuous because another president could take them away. So they're not written into law the way that all the other park units are.
Yeah.
Sometimes national monuments can also be administered by another, you know, like Mount St. Helens is a national monument after the volcano, but it was a national forest before. So it's run by the National Forest Service, but mm-hmm. almost all the national monuments are managed by the national parks.
Yeah.
So I know that's a lot about land management titles, but I don't want people to think that, you know, only these 8 great places and the rest are second tier or something. They're
yeah,
not.
I'm really glad you talked about that, Jay. So if I were to, from someone who doesn't have the same deep knowledge about those structures that you do, were to try to summarize that, or you give an example of it, would it be like saying, for example, Gates of the Arctic National Park, which does have that national parks designation and is a place we've both been to, comparing that to something like Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve, which is another place we've been that's very remote and hard to get to, but it isn't any less interesting or unique, yeah, really, than Gates of the Arctic. And it's in a similar, I mean, it's very different, but also sort of in a similar part of interior, kind of this subarctic Arctic area. With that, is that kind of getting at what you're saying?
I think maybe the best example might be Kobuk and Noatak. So Kobuk Valley National Park, Noatak National Preserve, very close to each other along the drainage of the Noatak and Kobuk rivers. They're in the west part of the Brooks Range. Really remote places. I mean, really remote. No matter how backcountry you think you've ever been, this is more so.
Yeah.
But to be honest, there isn't really any, you know, Kobuk is a national park, Noatak is a preserve. They're not that different, right? It's just a naming convention. It has politics and stuff. So anyway, I know that's a small thing, but it always rankles me a little bit when I see that. I'm like I feel like some of the non-named parks are getting disrespected.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. Like, what about Noatak? Noatak is so cool.
Yeah. And you know, some of these like wild rivers and stuff too are really quite amazing. So yeah, I think that's probably enough a detail about national parks and their names.
Yeah, that's good though. Thank you. I will just add before we move on, I'm thinking especially about Skagway and Sitka that have national historic parks that we've both been to in Alaska. And those are some of the coolest things, that some of the most wonderful places I've been to in Alaska, especially from like a history kind of standpoint. I mean, they're both really different from each other and super interesting. So definitely if you're going to Sitka or Skagway, don't miss those places. They're really cool. Yeah. Oh, that also reminds me that when I was mentioning the previous episodes of the podcast where we talked about parks, in episode 9, which was just a couple weeks ago, in our episode with Scott McMurrin, he talked quite a bit about Wrangle St. Elias in that episode, even though that's not the title of the episode. So I wanted to make sure to mention that also. Okay, so Jay, thinking about Alaska's national parks, I was thinking it'd be fun for us to talk a little bit about some of the things that make them really wonderful places to visit in Alaska. And of course, they're very different. Some of them are easier to get to. Some of them are harder to get to. But what would you say in general are some of the benefits of visiting a national park in Alaska?
Well, I'm biased. I'm going to say the National Park Service.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm going to say that is not just to butter up my former coworkers. It's because I think the National Park Service, Alaska's public lands and Alaska land in general, it's pretty difficult to visit. And the Park Service has done a really good job of providing some things that visitors really need without providing some that they don't. The National Park Service doesn't feel it's necessary to provide fudge shops.
Really? I feel like NPS fudge could be a really big hit.
I'd buy it. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the things that appear in visitor areas that aren't necessarily required are not necessary. But the Park Service has made sure that there are good maps, relatively good maps of all the national parks. And information is available online at nps.gov and the really excellent new NPS app.
Yeah.
Feel like that makes a big difference. And the Park Service has a mission about getting that information out there. So I think that's really, and they're going to provide structured hiking.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? What do you think?
Well, I definitely agree with what you said about the resources and infrastructure of the Park Service around giving, you know, really excellent information and being, having that be their mission. I would say that in addition to that, you sort of mentioned like having hiking trails, and there are some really amazing hikes in Alaska's national parks. There's lots of space where there aren't hiking trails, but where there are, those are some really wonderful trails, and hiking is free. So Alaska can be an expensive destination, and going for a hike in a national park doesn't cost anything. And that is pretty cool. Some Alaska parks charge an entrance fee, but many of them do not, actually. So even that barrier is not there for many parks. And I think the other thing is, if you are going to camp on your trip to Alaska, Alaska's national parks have some of the best tent camping situations in Alaska. If you're in an RV, there are other places that are also pretty amazing. But when I think about the best places to pitch a tent in Alaska that I've personally experienced, they're nearly all in national parks. So those are some of the other things that come to mind. Yeah.
And I will say that the camping in national parks tends to be a bargain all over.
Yes. Yep. It's
really cheaper than state parks nearby.
Yes.
And, you know, I feel like if you have an option to tent camp in the national park, do it.
Yes. So like, for example, in Katmai, the lodge, which you have to win a lottery to get into 2 years in advance, is $900 a night, and the campground is $12 a night, just as an example of that.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And also in Glacier Bay and Wrangell St. Elias, camping is free. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's not uncommon, actually.
No, it's not.
I will say, too, that there, having worked in fee collections in national parks, I know that a lot of folks are frustrated at paying an admissions fee or to come through the gate or for some of the fees, which is, again, as Jenny said, a lot of national parks don't charge any fee whatsoever. They actually have to get permission from Congress to do so. most of that money does not go to the National Park Service. Actually, it goes into the general fund of the U.S. government. And the fee, when you do pay one, doesn't even come close to paying for the cost of most people's visit. So
yeah,
it is an amazing bargain. And I know that it still sucks to have to fork over some money at the gate, but you know,
yeah.
You
get it free.
So,
yes. So let's talk about challenges a little bit. What are some of the biggest challenges from your perspective about visiting Alaska's parks?
There are a lot, actually.
Yeah, there are.
They vary a tremendous amount based on the park itself. And this is one of the things that, like, folks who are doing bucket list visits, for example, and they're like, I'm going to visit all the named national parks and they want to go to Kobuk. Like, oh, I only have two left. You could spend a majority of your summer getting to some of the Alaska national parks, just basically, you know, getting there. So getting there is not always easy. Some of them it's very easy. Actually, Denali is very easy to get to. You can drive there on the road system. You can take a train there, take a bus into the park. That's not too bad. Yukon Charlie, not so easy. You can take a boat up the river from Eagle, I guess. I'm trying to think of even, or most likely you would fly in on a float plane. Same with Gates of the Arctic, same with Noatak, Kobuk. Really, those are air dependent. Hiking to some of those parks from the nearest place you can get on commercial air service, for example, would take your whole season or more. Like, it's not a possible to do. So that's a challenge. Mosquitoes are a challenge that I don't want to underestimate. Some of the parks have a very short season where the snow is free, and the Brooks Range, Northern Alaska parks can have a 6 or 8 week snow-free season. So that part of the season will also be when the mosquitoes have to make their entire living and the mosquitoes will be dense.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, if you think you know mosquitoes, you do not. I, working up there, remember wiping over and over, wiping my head net with my gloved hands to be able to see my notebook to take notes.
Yeah.
No, they're...
I will say, Jay, that when I spent that week with you guys on your project in Gates, that forever changed my perspective on bugs and what are bad bugs. Right? So much.
No, I've worked in the Everglades, and I'll tell you that it's nothing.
Yeah, it was intense.
Not to be, you know, they're a serious barrier, and they're completely manageable, and you can make, in most parks in Alaska, you can make a huge difference based on when you visit. If you are not someone, and they're not that bad everywhere by any means, but they can be a real issue anywhere in Alaska. I mean, we had one of the weirdest nights of mosquitoes with a friends of ours at a campground near Anchorage, just out of nowhere.
Yeah, that was also really bizarre. Yeah.
So, you know, it can happen anywhere, and an early freeze can make a glorious clearance of the skies. And so, you know, late season can be good, but you know, you're not going to want to try to visit some of these more remote parks during the late season for the mosquitoes, because the door can close weather-wise on you and you could be shut out. So, you know, you're playing chicken.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're way more of an expert than I am on the travel component. I mean, what do you think about the lodging expense?
Yeah.
Sides of it. All right, what do you think? Do you have anything you want to add about that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything that you said. I think, despite what I said before about being able to find free or very inexpensive camping in Alaska national parks, lodging that is not camping is real expensive in places like Denali and Seward, which is near Kenai Fjords, and King Salmon, which is near Katmai. So that is, I think, a challenge. I think it's important for people to be prepared for that, for lodging to be very expensive, especially for what it is. So that's one thing. And I think, you know, earlier you were talking about how the national park name is really just a naming convention. And from the perspective of an insider in the Park Service, that isn't necessarily different from a wild river or a national preserve. But you know that I help people plan their trips to Alaska. And I've had several clients who were definitely wanting to go to the 8 parks with the national park designation to complete the list of 63. And I know there are way more, but, you know, from my client's perspective. And I think the biggest challenge, especially for folks trying to go to a lot of remote parks in one trip, is it really makes the trip extremely complicated and very dependent on weather. So again, if that's something that you want to do as a traveler, just really think about giving yourself as much time as possible and lots of extra time in between parks to allow for things like weather delays.
Right. And I think what I heard you saying too about lodging is that if you're going to be if you want to use lodging like hotels, lodges, etc., you should make that plan far in advance.
Yes. Yes. I would say for national parks, except for Glacier Bay, you really need to be planning your trip a year ahead of time. Yeah. Denali, like for example, we are recording this in April of 2023. And there are some dates where there is still lodging available in Denali, especially if you drive there as opposed to taking the train, because you can stay a little further away from the park if you do that. But there are lots of days that are completely booked up or very close to that. So, yeah, I think planning, and for these remote parks, you really need to plan a year in advance, or at least 6 to 9 months. Kind of the more remote, the earlier you need to plan, I think is what I would say. And after the break, we'll get into kind of which parks are the most remote and that kind of thing. But I think that's what I would say about the challenges with planning.
I just want to take a moment to say that I applaud anyone who has a goal of visiting all the national parks. I just want to add on that for extra credit, you should think about including as many of the other 340 units that are not named national park in the national park system.
Yes.
There's over 400 units, and some of them are absolutely mind-blowing, and don't rule those out just because of their name.
Totally agree with that.
I think with the 63 named national parks is a really great life goal.
Yes, I agree. I think it's really cool. And I sometimes think I would like to take it on too, but I haven't committed to that yet. All right, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the different types of parks based on how remote they are in Alaska and talk about some of our personal favorites. So we'll be back soon. Hi, everyone. Jenny here. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. If you're listening in real time in April 2024 and you're planning to travel to Alaska this summer, it's not too late. Let me help you make that dream trip come true through one of my planning sessions, or even planning the whole thing for you if you'd like more help. Follow the link in the show notes that's just below the tip jar to book a session with me. Want to do it on your own? That's also awesome. Take my free 4-question quiz to get an itinerary suggestion based on your travel style and your personal dreams for your trip. The link to that is in the show notes too. All right, back to the show. And we're back. And in today's episode, to honor National Parks Week, Jay and I are sharing a bit about the Alaska National Parks, which is something that we both have quite a bit of experience with in different ways.
So, Jenny, I know you have helped coach a lot of people with visiting Alaska National Parks, in particular, folks who are looking for the named national parks.
Yep.
I have heard you discuss this as that there being three categories broadly of Alaska National Parks. Can you share those with our listeners?
Sure. Yes. So for this section, we're just talking about those eight parks with the named designation of National Park, even though the others, as Jay said earlier in the episode, are really important to consider. But if we did this for every single one of those, that would be a little overwhelming and make this podcast way too long. So, awesome. So I am going to keep it to that for the most part, although I may mention some of the others when it fits in. So, yeah, Jay, I kind of put them in three buckets, if you will. One is the ones that are accessible by road and have hotels and or services of some kind. The second is ones that are hard to get to, but do have some kind of services. And then the third is what I call the really remote parks, the ones with no services of any kind and off the road system that you'd be getting to in a small plane. So yeah, I think I'll just share a few details about each of those buckets and which parks go in those buckets. For the first one, which is the ones accessible by road and have hotels and services, that would be three: Denali, Kenai Fjords, and Wrangell St. Elias. Wrangell St. Elias is a little bit of a question mark if it fits in that bucket, because while you can get there by road, most rental car companies will not allow you to drive on that road because it's very remote and gravel. I will tell you that it's not a particularly scary road to drive. It's just remote and gravel, so it's really slow. So for those three parks, it's a little more straightforward. You can drive there. Denali and Kenai Fjords, you can also take the Alaska Railroad to. All three of those have lodges or hotels that are in the basic area. And they have things like restaurants and that sort of thing. Wrangell St. Elias doesn't have a lot of restaurants, but it does have a couple. It doesn't really have a store, but it has hotels, restaurants. There's no cell service there. Kenai Fjords and Denali, as far as whether or not there's cell service, kind of depends on exactly where you are in the park. So that's kind of a summary of the first bucket. The second bucket is the ones that are hard to get to, but still have some services. So I put three parks in that category as well, and that would be Glacier Bay, Katmai, and sort of Lake Clark. And in those three, you're going to be taking a plane or a boat to get there. Glacier Bay is a little funky because 95% of people visit Glacier Bay on cruise ships. But if you go on your own, you'll still be getting there by boat or small plane. These are ones, if you're going to Glacier Bay on a cruise, cruises are one of those things that you can plan later. There's lots of availability for cruises that go to Glacier Bay now in April for this summer, 2023. There are some nights available at the lodge. So that one you don't have to plan quite as far ahead. Katmai, you have to plan far ahead. The campground opens for reservations in early January and books up for the whole summer within 5 minutes. So you definitely want to prepare ahead for that. There's a lottery 2 years ahead of time for the lodge. For day trips from Anchorage into Katmai, that's also a good one to plan at least by the fall for that coming summer. And Lake Clark has plane service that goes in there, small plane service. There are some lodges you can stay at. That one you really need to plan about a year ahead of time. In some cases, you might be able to find dates later, but you want to book that one as soon as possible too, because you're going to be looking at remote lodges for Lake Clark. And then finally, you know, as you and I know, Gates of the Arctic and Kobuk Valley, they're very, very remote. The only way really to get in there is in a small chartered plane. There's no scheduled small plane service into those parks. There are no trails. There are no services. So if you want to go to either of those parks, you need to plan really far ahead, and like a year. And there's two ways to do it. You can either do a fly-in trip where you can land and walk around, or you can do a backpacking or rafting trip with a guide. And those are kind of really the only practical ways to get to those parks. So that would be kind of my summary about the different buckets and how to get there.
I think that's really helpful. And to be honest, it applies to the other national park units as well. They all would fit into one of those buckets.
Yeah.
The majority of the non-named national parks would be
yes
into the more remote ones and less than that. I have a kind of a random question for you. If someone is trying to chain together a lot of national park visits, how many could they realistically get in a single visit, do you think?
Well, it's a great question, because I've had clients who've done all of them in one trip to Alaska. Yeah. It's all about time and money. So if you want to go to all of these parks in one trip to Alaska, you're looking at a minimum of a 1 month trip. In a month, even, that's going to be a lot of running around. It's going to be a lot of small planes and hiking and cars and boats and just all kinds of things. But it can be done if you're really determined. Personally, I think it's better, especially if you live on the West Coast and it's easier for you to get to Alaska, meaning the flights are shorter and less expensive. Then I think it's really nice to break it up into at least two and ideally three trips. That's kind of my personal opinion. Gates and Kobuk Valley work well together. There is an operator in Kotzebue that does a combo flight scene trip. It's called Golden Eagle Outfitters, and they do a flight scene trip where you can land in both parks. I have had clients who've done that, and it's a great trip. You have to get to Kotzebue, but you can get there on Alaska Airlines. Katmai and Lake Clark are also ones that go well together, because there's different ways to do it, but you can fly between them, go to both of those. Wrangell St. Elias and Denali go really well together, and Kenai Fjords, because the distances are long, but they are all driving parks, and you could make a plan, you know, far enough ahead that you could rent from a small local company that lets you rent a car you can take to Wrangell St. Elias. Glacier Bay, I think that really needs ideally to be its own trip, either on your own or on a cruise. So I guess in my ideal world, for someone who wanted to do that, it would be four trips, but you can definitely do it in one if you have the patience for that much running around and the budget and time to support it.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds, even in 1 month, sounds really hectic to me.
Oh yeah. It's crazy, but it's not crazy. I mean, it's just a lot of traveling. So if you're up for that, it's great. Yeah. It's a great adventure. That's for sure.
Yeah. Maybe the whole summer would be a great thing to aim for if you wanted to do that.
Yeah. So Jay, can you talk a little bit about park visitation numbers and sort of humans in national parks and kind of what your perspective is on that?
Yeah, I have unpopular opinions, maybe. I don't know. But I do think there's no, that's not exactly true. But I do want to take a moment to say first that I, first of all, am a huge proponent of wildlands, of wilderness, of protecting lands from development. But sometimes I hear that being taken in a direction that I think is a little bit disrespectful. And what I'm getting at about that is that all of this great wilderness in Alaska has a long, long human history, really long.
Yeah.
Some of the oldest sites in North America archaeologically are in Alaska's national parks. There are a number of sites 13, 14,000 years old up there. And, the oldest sites in North America are only a little bit older than that. So human history is quite long. And I've seen brochures and stuff that talk about, come walk in a valley where the mountains have no names and no one's ever walked before. And yeah, that's just not true. There's a deep human history in this place. It just didn't leave condos. And, I just want to throw out that I think it's the idea of wilderness needs to not exclude the fact that humans were there and that they had an impact. The folks who lived there intentionally used fire and their hunting techniques and stuff to make the landscape livable for them. And the landscape, like of Gates of the Arctic, for example, or for one, is the humans have been living there since before the current biological regime. So, black spruce have only been they're the most dominant tree in northern central Alaska, and they've only been around for about 5,000 years. And humans have been living in those places. Swan Point down in the Tanana Valley is almost 15,000 years old. So, we're
That's
talking,
amazing.
yeah, humans have been here three times longer there than the black spruce have been there. So
Yeah.
it's really deep. And it's hard sometimes to picture that people have been living on this landscape so long. I had the opportunity to work on a site near Delta Junction in Alaska, and we were excavating these fires where and all these bones, and then suddenly we started getting into animals that have been extinct in North America, and it just blew my mind. Like, there were people here camping in this spot that were eating like camel and prehistoric antelope that don't exist on North America and haven't since the end of the Ice Age. So I think that's just really cool, and I would love for people to include that in their appreciation of the wild lands and
Yeah.
not think humans as something the human history on a place like somehow corrupts it.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful part of it. So that's one thing. Another one is another one of those sets of I want to just take on for a moment. You'll see a lot of things on the internet where people talk about the most and least visited national parks. In your experience of other people while you're there may not track with what you see on those. There's a couple of reasons. One, national park visitation numbers are kind of funny. So a national park like Yellowstone, for example, has a pretty great number. The people go through the gates, they count them. People leave, they count them. It's very like other national parks like Gates of the Arctic have numbers. I don't remember what their visitation numbers say, but they count every person who drives on the haul road to Prudhoe Bay, most of whom never enter the park at all. So they count because they go through a visitor center area at the Yukon River. Olympic National Park, for example, has also really difficult numbers. There's a Washington State has a there's a US 101 highway runs through it. And they count the folks who drive that highway as visiting the park because you don't really know whether they did or not. So it's not quite the same. They're not apples to apples. And so when you see numbers for a place like Gates of the Arctic, for example, they're actually a lot higher than what you would actually experience going there. So if you want and are looking for that really remote, distant thing, don't really pay attention to those numbers. They don't necessarily mean that much. Some parks, the people are crowded into very small areas. And in every national park in the entire system, you can have solitude. You just need to step away. I would say Denali, we had great conversations with Donna and Tom Hobecker, which will be in another episode.
Yeah. 3 weeks. I think that episode will be live.
And they really highlighted that if you get off the bus in Denali, you can have one of the most remote experiences you can imagine in your life, all within a very easy, secure way to experience it. And the same with Gates. There is nothing like the realization that you are 2 or 3 weeks hike from another human being. But then there's something like Glacier Bay. Jenny, I haven't been there. I know you have. But, you know, the main way to visit Glacier Bay is on board a cruise ship, which is not an isolated...
No.
So the numbers there don't necessarily match up to your experience if you went there and camped. And what was your experience of camping as far as...
Well, there were two other people staying in the campground when I was there. So, yeah.
I haven't been there, but what would you say about Katmai? About like, will you, it's my impression is that you would be around a lot of other people all the time because people are quite limited in where they go.
Yeah, Katmai was really different, say, from Glacier Bay, because there were lots of people camping in Katmai. I think there's 60 people that can be in the campground a night. And yeah, in Glacier Bay, you know, people are a little more spread out and there are just so few people, like we talked about in the Glacier Bay episode, who are traveling there, not on a cruise ship. You know, it's really just the other people staying at the lodge and in the campground that you see. Katmai is really busy with day trip visitors. When I was there, it wasn't super busy, even though it was high season, because it was really foggy and a lot of the flights were canceled. But there was one day where it was raining, but it wasn't foggy and the flights were able to get in. And yeah, there were times when you had to wait for a couple hours to go out on the platform to see the bears. So that definitely felt busy, even though it's really not that many people. So I think those things do kind of illustrate what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's just kind of all I wanted to say about that. I think is just that if you are looking for solitude, it's there for you. It won't track with just sorting by, you know, sort the list by visitation number, pick the lowest.
Yeah.
It is a choose your own adventure as to how much or how little human contact you want while you're there.
Yes.
So you mentioned hiking, and I'm not a hiker. I am always quite open about that.
Yeah.
I hike for money, but I think hiking is obviously a way to get, you know, in Yellowstone, we used to say, if you go 100 yards off the road, you will drop 90% of the people.
Yeah. And
I definitely think that's even more so in Alaska. So it's a great way to find solitude if you want. What do you think the best hike is in Alaska National Park?
Okay. That's a really tough question to answer, because I'm just going to say, Jay said he's not a hiker unless he's getting paid. I can vouch that's totally true. I, however, am a hiker. And if you're a hiker, you've got to do a hike in an Alaskan national park. It's just fantastic on your trip. So I'm going to say the Harding Icefield Trail in Kenai Fjords National Park, which is near Seward. It is a really hard hike, really hard, but you don't have to go all the way to the end to see the amazing views. So I think the views are what make that hike truly spectacular. I don't think it's worth it if you can't see the view. It doesn't have to be perfect weather, but there does have to be good visibility. So I think that would be my answer.
I'm going to show my ignorance for a moment here. What about Portage Pass? That's one of my favorites, but that's probably in the forest, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in Chugach National Forest.
I was just trying
to remember. It is an awesome hike, and it's not as difficult as Harding Icefield.
Totally. Okay, so while we're on the superlatives of
yes,
the national parks,
Yes.
What do you think is the best visitor center in an Alaska National Park?
Well, going back to what you said earlier, Jay, the Park Service does a really good job of sharing information and doing interpretation. I mean, that's part of what they do. So I've been to bad visitor centers, but not in Alaska. All the ones I've been to there are amazing. Some of them are really tiny and like kind of right next to the airport, like the one in King Salmon for Katmai and the other Park Service lands around King Salmon. But that's just because of the remote location. It's still pretty amazing what they did with like a tiny little corner of an airplane hangar, basically. So they're all really good, but I think I'm gonna have two answers for this one. One is kind of sassy, but the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park Visitor Center that is located along the Richardson Highway in Copper Center is not only an excellent visitor center, but it also has the best bathrooms along the Richardson Highway. So I feel like it needs to get some props for that. Minor thing. Aside from that, I think I would really encourage you to, if you're going to Alaska, to go to one of the public lands information centers. There's four of them in Alaska. There's one in Tok along the Alaska Highway, one in Ketchikan, which is a great one to go to if you're on a cruise, and one in downtown Anchorage and one in downtown Fairbanks. And even though they are not in national parks, they really get at all of these things Jay has been talking about around like public land in Alaska in general. And they're good visitor centers and they have lots of free maps and lots of great information. So they're just a fantastic visitor resource for pretty much anyone.
Yes, I am really glad you gave them a shout out. The public lands info centers are unsung heroes for sure. And, you know,
Totally.
underutilized as resources, in my opinion.
Yes.
Well, if you're a map geek, which I am definitively a map geek,
Same.
amazing files of maps
Yeah.
and spread them out on a table and like lay out. And it's pretty beautiful. It warms my heart to spread out like 20 topo maps
Yeah.
into. To bigger.
Super fun.
And one cool thing about it too is that they can kind of help guide you. There are certain types of land use that are not appropriate for national parks. You know, hunting is generally not allowed in any national park property.
Right.
And you know, if you're a hunter or if you want to go for, you know, riding dirt bikes or four wheelers or that kind of thing, national parks are not really where you want to go. And riding stock, horseback is or is not, depending on the national park, acceptable. And they can really help guide you and say, like, oh, what you want to do would be best suited to this, you know, state park. A lot of national parks have a state park ring around them.
Yep.
And a lot of times that land is much more open, rule-wise, for better or for worse. And Denali is definitely that way.
Yeah.
Depending on what you want to do, the public lands info people can really help guide you. You know, and all the people that I've met at a Public Lands Info Center have been rock stars. Just great.
Yeah. Absolutely. I totally agree.
Okay, so what do you think is the best tour, as opposed to a hike or a visitor center, but like the best package tour from a park vendor in a national park?
This is a very easy one. It would be the day boat tour in Glacier Bay National Park. It's
Really?
just absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
That's cool. I'm going to give a shout out to the cheapest tour in a national park. Just the Denali bus system.
Okay, the Denali bus system is also really cool, and it would be my number two is any
A
trip
tour.
into Denali on a bus. But the Glacier Bay day boat takes the edge for me. But I totally agree with you about Denali. It's also very cool.
I'm just saying that the cost is
Yes,
for what
it's
you
very
get.
affordable. Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, if since you gave me an opening to talk about the Denali bus tour, whether you take the narrated tour or the bus, the hiker bus, the like hop on, hop off transit bus, if you are going to Denali, do not skip the bus tour because you think you don't want to go on a bus. And also make sure you listen to the episode we have coming up with Tom and Donna in 3 weeks about Denali. If I'm not convincing you, that is the way to get away from it all in Denali. And you absolutely have to do it when you're there.
If you're into national parks at all, you should listen to that episode because Tom Hobbiter, first of all, he's just written a memoir book that you should read. And also he is an OG, the real deal
national park
career ranger.
Yes.
And he's a great resource. We were really lucky to get them on. Mostly we talked to them because Jenny and Donna worked together as school counselor.
Yes.
So we're cashing in that particular chip.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I am also going to throw out I'm just going to say that I want to give a shout out to Brooks Range Aviation in Buttles. No business interests or relationship with us, but their tour fly into near the Arrogance Peaks into Gates of the Arctic will explode your frontal lobe as far
as
that beautiful landscape and rugged could look like. So I'm going to give a shout out to that, but it is not cheap and it is very remote. Just getting to Battles itself is kind of a process. So
yes,
but I just want to give those guys a shout out because they do an amazing job.
Yes. And that would be a flight scene tour of Gates of the Arctic.
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the Arctic. So, okay. Last superlative I'm going to ask you, I think. Best campsite.
Okay. In a national park in Alaska.
Park in Alaska, yes.
Okay. I am going to allow, since this is the last question, I'm going to allow myself three answers. So they're good for different reasons. So first of all, probably the best campsite anywhere in Alaska's national parks is definitely Jumbo Creek in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Now, this campsite is a hassle to get to, so that's why I'm not going to give it as my only answer. It looks like a campground when you read about it on the internet, but it is not. It is a backcountry camp. It's about 2 miles from Kennecott. So to get there, you have to drive or fly to McCarthy. Then you have to get a ride out to Kennecott, get a backcountry permit, and then hike for 2 miles. But once you do that, it's this beautiful location with an amazing view of the Wrangell Mountains and the Root Glacier. So it's super cool if you can make that happen. And then my other answer that's a little out there would be the Bartlett Cove Campground in Glacier Bay. And it's kind of an amazing campground because not only is it free, but they provide water, bear-proof storage. You can pay to take a shower in the lodge. You can do your laundry in the lodge. And also, when you're in your tent at night, if you're super lucky, you might hear whales like breathing in Bartlett Cove. And that is just really amazing. I don't really have words for what that's like. And hearing birds call and, like, you know, other marine mammals splashing around out there. It's really cool. But that's also hard to get to. So to answer your question, Jay, for one that is easier to get to, I'm going to say the Savage River Campground in Denali. You can drive to it. And I feel like one drive-in one has to be on the list here. It's a really nice alternative to Riley Creek, which is at the park entrance. It's much quieter and smaller, and it's right next to the Savage River, and there is a beautiful hike you can do there, especially in the evening and the morning. The light there is just stunning. So
absolutely,
that's going to be probably my real answer.
Yeah, and I feel like that Savage River one is also, it has, it just has a different feel than Riley Creek, which
is big. Yep, yeah. And Riley Creek is also great, but Savage River is just a really special place, I think.
Savage River opens and closes, tends to be open and closed later and earlier, respectively. Riley Creek is broader availability.
Yes, that's true.
Yep. Your window is slightly smaller for it. But the sites are, and the sites are less developed, and I like that. I'm personally an off-trail hiker and an off-site camper, so I like
that.
But if you, you know, want like a perfectly groomed spot for your tent or whatever, it's not necessarily as good, but it is a spectacular campground. World class.
Yes. Definitely.
Those are pretty good answers. I'll let you go with that.
Thank you. So as we move towards wrapping up this episode, you know, Jay, a few minutes ago, you were talking about the importance of the human experience in the national parks and that these vast, stunning wilderness landscapes have also been home to humans for thousands of years. And in addition to humans who have lived in Alaska's parks for thousands of years, there are also lots of humans who live in Alaska's parks now and live and work there. So could you tell us just a little bit about some of the types of jobs people have in national parks that might not be visible to a visitor in the same way that, say, rangers are visible?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of cachet with being a ranger, and I want to give full props to those rangers out there. There's kind of two wings of people that we would generally hear people refer to as a ranger. One is a law enforcement officer inside the Park Service. Generally, that's what people mean if they just say ranger. That's a person who has a law enforcement credential. They're a badged law enforcement officer. They will be carrying a weapon. They'll have training from the federal government in law enforcement. And then there's the ranger naturalist, which is the person who's often working at a visitor center desk or leading hikes, that kind of stuff. And that's an interpretive ranger or a ranger naturalist. But 2/3 of the people in the National Park Service work in maintenance. It's the unsung, they're the unsung heroes, in my opinion. And I'm biased because my father was a career long maintenance worker in a national park. But these guys work, you know, and gals, they work hard. Their pay is actually generally fairly low. The joke is always you get paid in sunsets. And a lot of folks are seasonal workers, and then they have to put together work in their off parts of the year. And so, you know, that's a lot of the real work that gets done is by these folks. And if you're a person who has seasonal availability, think about it. It's a great way to serve the country and be in a beautiful place. And the environment of national park employees, I like a lot. And I think if you listen to Donna and Tom's interview in a few weeks, you'll get a better feel for it. And, you know, they can be a little bit like a small family in the better and the worst ways. But you know, folks are driving trucks and cleaning the campgrounds and collecting money and dispatch operators and fixing roads, cutting trees that are about to fall onto camps, like all that kind of stuff. There's just a lot of work that has to be done in a national park. And it goes kind of unnoticed. And it's always a running joke that like people will want to add ranger to their titles for the public recognition. Like, you know, I'm a garbage ranger. I want to also add in just the sheer number of scientists. It's a huge mission of the National Park Service to understand the national parks better. And, you know, so ornithologists and everything from the trees to the birds to the archaeological, the history, all this stuff. There are scientists in all the national parks who are doing amazing research in a fairly hidden way, really. So just, I'd love, you know, when you see stuff in the national parks, you know, just remember there are a lot of folks back there making it happen for you, and they love it. They love their work. And, but it's good for you to notice them, I think, sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. So speaking of noticing and thanking people who have served in the National Park Service, to bring this episode to a close, Jay and I want to honor during this National Parks Week the friends and family that we know personally who have served in the National Park Service. And a few of these people are rangers. Most of them are people who've worked in maintenance or in administration or are scientists or have been scientists for the National Park Service.
Yeah. And we're, yeah, I would love to, and I, if I miss anyone, it's not intentional. It's I'm just sometimes kind of scatterbrained, but I'm going to list off some folks that come to mind. Matt Enderle, he was just on, he will have his episodes already played, right?
Yeah. And Glacier Bay.
Tom and Donna Hobecker, who will be on soon. Dan Otis, who is in DC serving, and that is the most unsung service in the National Park Service, to work in the DC offices.
So unsung. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan, for all you do. And, you know, maybe we'll have to get him on the podcast sometime too.
Yeah, I think so.
Molly Odell, she'll also be on the podcast sometime. Jeff Rasick and Julie Esdale, great archaeologists up in Fairbanks. Natasha Slobodna, who has an absolute rugged woman of the wild and archaeologist. Aaron Wilson, Andy Tremaine, Christina Jensen, who died in the field and 20 years ago almost now.
Yeah.
Adam Freiberg. Kirstie Hertel, my last boss in the National Park Service and one of the best, and fellow park brat, I want to say. Yeah, she comes from a distinguished line of National Park Service heroes. And last but not least, George Monroe, who was my coach and role model when I was a young Jay. He was the boat ranger in Yellowstone. It really meant a lot to me. So I want to thank all those folks for the service they've given.
And finally, Jay's family, Jay's parents, Ray and Mary, who raised him in the Park Service, and Jay's sister Julie and Jay himself. Both Julie and Jay have both worked for the National Park Service for many seasons as adults. Thank you so much to all of you for your service to our country. And thanks to all of you out there for listening to Alaska Uncovered. If you like what you heard today, we would love to have you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any new episodes. They come out every Wednesday. Bye for now.
Bye.